Good afternoon, everyone. Before we get started with the news here, we want to thank a few people for donating during our spring drive here at KFSK, your community radio station. A thanks goes out to Judy Jenke and Abel Cardenas. Thank you to you both for your donation to KFSK. For KFSK News, I am Angela Denning. Today is Thursday, May the 5th. Thanks for joining us. An Alaska mariculture bill that would allow shellfish to be farmed in hatcheries is one step closer to becoming law. The State House agreed to changes made to House Bill 41 last week. The bill would allow certain nonprofits to pursue mariculture enhancement or restoration projects for species of shellfish like abalone, razor clams, and king crab. It would be the first time in Alaska's history that people could raise animals like crab in hatcheries and then release them into the wild to support commercial fisheries. The bill was sponsored by independent Representative Dan Ortez and presented in February last year.
HB 41 plays, like I said, a key role in kind of one of the key pieces and building blocks to make mariculture a growing and significant part of the overall Alaska fisheries portfolio, if you will.
The bill outlines safety standards and a framework for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to manage projects for growing shellfish and keeping stocks healthy. Ortez says it's just one piece of the puzzle for bolstering Alaska's fishing industry.
There's lots of other things that have already happened and need to continue to happen in order to make that dream of perhaps one day a $1 billion a year industry added to an already $5 billion, $6 billion a year industry.
He says right now the capital budget has about $5 million for new mariculture projects. An important next step, Ortez says, is the state expanding that number.
One thing, though, I'd like to see before the session ends is to see if we can get that number closer to the $25 million requested.
Now that House Bill 41 is passed the legislature, it moves to Governor Dunleavy's desk for signing. The Biden administration has highlighted a number of initiatives aimed at curtailing logging and old-growth forests on federal land, including the Tongass National Forest. But those federal efforts only go so far in protecting the Southeast Alaska rainforest. That's because federal protections don't apply to land that's been removed from the Tongass National Forest through land swaps and transfers. Satellite data shows that in recent years, nearly half of all logging in the Tongass region happened on land that was removed from the federal management. Eric Stone has this story on why federal forest conservation policies like the roadless rule fall short of preserving the Tongass.
I'm riding with Nocatee Bay resident Mark Figelski in his compact SUV on some of the logging roads that crisscross Prince of Wales Island. He's giving me a tour and foraging for mushrooms.
Here, look at all that bear set over there. Holy moly, you see it?
We're in the middle of an immense swath of land that was until recently home to trees hundreds of years old. It's an old-growth forest here on Prince of Wales Island that was recently reduced to stumps.
That's the only good thing about these dead and dying trees that has made the population of mushrooms go crazy. I mean, look at that right there.
It's not the only good thing, Figelski tells me. For one thing, without logging, we wouldn't be driving on the road we're currently on. But Figelski explains that the vast scale of these recent cuts just north of his home in Nocatee has him concerned. He tells me he relies on the land to feed his family. Deer, berries, mushrooms, the salmon that reproduce in streams that run through clear-cut, and halibut that often feed near river mouths. The nearest supermarkets are in Klawock and Thorne Bay. They're some 40-odd miles away.
So the subsistence life is all we have, really. That's why this is really so important.
Since President Joe Biden took office, federal authorities have trumpeted a number of policy changes aimed at preserving old-growth forest, including in the Tongass. Perhaps the initiative with the biggest impact on Southeast Alaska is an effort to reinstate the national roadless rule. It limits logging in more than half of the 17 million acres of the Tongass National Forest. Advocates say protections like the roadless rule are essential to maintaining both subsistence food sources for people who live in the rainforest and fighting climate change. Scientists say it's among the most carbon-dense forests in the world. Figelski says he was heartened by news of the Biden administration's efforts to restrict logging.
I was so excited when I heard about the roadless rural thing, and I thought, oh, for sure now they're going to cut this off.
But logging did not stop. If anything, it accelerated. That's because the roadless rule only protects land within the Forest Service's jurisdiction. And the land we're on was transferred from the Forest Service to the Alaska Mental Health Trust as part of a 2017 land swap. The organization has contracted with logging companies to clear-cut much of the land it was granted. And according to satellite data reviewed by Earthrise Media and Grist, some 43% of forest lost in the Tongass region between 2015 and 2020 happened on land that has been transferred out of federal management. The executive director of the Trust Land Office, Jesse Warner, says the organization's goal is to make money from the land to maximize revenue for its programs.
The Trust grants more than $20 million a year to partner organizations that provide services and supports to Alaskans with developmental disabilities and behavioral health conditions.
But Figelski wants people to know that splashy federal policy initiatives often don't tell the whole story.
What a victory everybody was celebrating about the roadless rule coming back, but really it means nothing if there's a back door.
Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski helped engineer the land transfer to the Mental Health Trust by inserting language in a must-pass bill in 2017. She says that while the land is no longer federally protected, there are still standards the loggers must abide by. But those state standards are looser than the federal rules. State fisheries biologist Mark Manillo stands on a bridge overlooking Yaddock Creek near Nocatee. He says smaller stream buffers allowed on state lands can damage the streams that subsistence and commercial fishermen alike rely on for salmon spawning.
Well, you can see this one here with this big exposed root wad. You know, you're going to get a lot of erosion off of that. Where the tree was standing, you can see you end up with, if this creek gets higher flows, you're probably going to get some flow through there, and it's going to erode.
The Mental Health Trust's land exchange is the most recent land swap affecting the Tongass, but it's nowhere near the size or scale of the 2014 transfer of 70,000 acres to Sea Alaska. The regional native corporation logged on land across Prince of Wales Island. It was always controversial, but it allowed the group to pay dividends to Alaska Native shareholders. Sea Alaska renounced commercial logging in 2021. It was a blow to the region's timber industry, but that doesn't mean more land transfers aren't being considered. In 2019, Sea Alaska invested at least $500,000 in a campaign that seeks to create five new independent Alaska Native Village corporations that would be allowed to select federal lands from the Tongass. The new corporation's shareholders would be descendants of the five village populations originally left out of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Tribal leaders on Prince of Wales Island say they're sympathetic to the landless community's situation, but they're worried that their forest lands will be targeted for their timber. Clinton Cook, president of the Craig Tribal Association, says he supports the landless tribe's efforts to right historical wrongs, but says he's concerned that it could lead to more logging on Prince of Wales Island.
We necessarily think they should probably, hopefully, will look at more areas in their community to be able to obtain that land, not necessarily on Prince of Wales, where there's already a little bit of a head start.
Former Sea Alaska board member Patrick Anderson says it's a thorny question without easy answers. That's because land near communities like Petersburg, Wrangell, and Ketchikan is already heavily developed and much of the nearby forest has already been logged.
I think there can be a negotiated end to it, but I believe that the parties need to have the opportunity to sit down and figure out what it is that a majority of the landless communities want.
Anderson says he's hopeful that if the landless communities do acquire old-growth forest lands, they might consider making money by selling carbon credits and keeping the forest intact. With additional reporting by Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick, Ed Boyda of Earthrise Media, and Clayton Aldern of Grist, I'm Eric Stone in Ketchikan.
And this story is a collaboration between Coast Alaska, KRBD, Grist, and Earthrise Media, and was supported by the Pulitzer Center. To read the full story, you can go to krbd.org. Petersburg High School's varsity baseball team won one and lost two in a home series against Thunder Mountain High School last week. The Vikings beat the Falcons 13-2 last Thursday and lost both games of a doubleheader Friday, 13-8 and 16-4. Petersburg also played a junior varsity game and lost 12-6 against Thunder Mountain on Saturday. Joe Vicknicki spoke with head coach Jim Engel about the game starting off with Thursday's win.
Our starting pitcher, Latham Johnson, is a senior, just pitched a gem of a game, nine strikeouts over four and two-thirds innings. We end up winning 13-2 in the mercy rule, five-inning game. It's the first time we've ever been on that side of it. So it's kind of a unique experience for all of us. But our guys, they just showed up and played really well. Good defense behind Latham, but Latham just didn't allow a lot of base runners. We were ahead 13 to nothing going into the fifth inning, and had a couple of mistakes made in the fifth inning. It cost us two runs, cost Latham the ability to finish out the five innings, which was kind of a bummer. Had to put Jack Engel in for the last out, just as his pitch count was getting kind of high. But had good run production from our lineup. We had six hits, which is, that's a normal game, normal high school game, as you'll see with the rest of the weekend, or the rest of the series. It was a lot more hits, but, you know, that was, it was across the board just good production. Kieran Cabral was 1 for 2 with 3 runs scored. Latham was 2 for 2, 3 runs scored. Jack Engel was 1 for 1 with 2 runs scored. And then we got production from Andrew Cole, who's our cleanup hitter, number 4, 1 for 3 for that game. Kyle Biggers bats 5. He had a run scored. Hunter Kahn bats 6. He had a run scored. Gage Masson bats 7. He had a run scored. So we had good production from the bulk of our lineup, which is always helpful. It means we got runners on base and guys are getting into scoring position. So all in all, really good. It was a well-executed game. Friday kind of felt rushed getting to the park. School gets out at 12:20. We played at 1:30. So really by the time guys got there, we had about 45 to 50 minutes to get ready to go. And it kind of felt that way. I feel like the guys didn't get warmed up the way they like to. We scored 8 runs that game. We ended up losing 13-8. We out-hit them 10-5. I was pleased with the game. Jack was a starting pitcher in that one. He struggled some pitching. Had a walk. His walk count was up kind of high, but offensively, he had a multi-hit home run game. He had a solo shot in the first inning, pulled the parking lot in left field, and then followed up in the seventh inning with an opposite field home run to the road, right center field. Latham Johnson was at third when that was hit, and so that was good to see his power. We actually had 3 home runs. We made some mistakes late in that game that put the game a little further out of reach than we wanted it to be. They're fixable mistakes. They're things that we're going to watch on film tonight before practice. Game 2 on Friday was Kieran Cabral started for us. Kieran did a great job catching for us the whole weekend, but he's our number 3 starter. It was a slugfest. We lost 16-14. We out-hit him 12-10. We just put runs on the board every single inning except for the seventh inning. So that was encouraging. Kieran went 4 for 5, 3 singles and a double, multi-RBIs. Andrew Cole hit a 2-run home run to center field. Kyle Biggers was 3 for 4, 2 singles and a triple. So, you know, if we can, in both game 1 and game 2, if we can reduce our walks, it'll really help our chances of winning the game. We just need to be a little more consistent in finding the strike zone and not give them an opportunity to get on base. We hit a few batters when we needed to not hit them. We had 3 errors in this game, too, that cost us several runs. So if we could eliminate that one inning where they scored 8 runs in the fourth inning, if we can eliminate that inning, reduce that a little bit, it's a different ballgame for us. I like where it's at. I like where we're at. I'm pleased. We got a lot of work to do, but I'm pleased with the way our bats have been hitting since the day one. We had good defense, really good play from my outfield. I was really pleased with particularly the way my corners played, which is Rylan Smith, a senior, and Gage Masson, a freshman. Rylan plays left field, and Gage plays right field. They really did a fine job for us. Gage made some kind of acrobatic plays on some line drives and got the outs. And Rylan just consistently got the ball back into to the infield quickly. Got great play out of Owen Anderson at second base. He's really developing into a good second baseman for us and starting to really hit the ball well. It's going to be exciting to see where he's at by the end of the season. That's an eager group of kids. They're excited to study game film tonight, so it's kind of cool that we get to do that. We got a tough opponent coming in this weekend. Ketchikan's a tough team. They're going to be they are sound from top to bottom. They make you pitch strikes, and they foul off strikes. They make you pitch more pitches than you want to pitch. And if they get on base, they are aggressive, and we're going to have to really be able to shut them down. And then we need to bring the bats. So it'll be interesting to see where we're at.
And that was Petersburg High School's head baseball coach, Jim Engel, speaking about the last games. The team hosts Ketchikan this weekend with games Friday at 4 o'clock and Saturday at 9 a.m. and 4 p.m. For KFSK News, I'm Angela Denning. Thanks for listening.